Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Monday, April 4th, 2016. If you're joining us off-net, we're still in Juneau, Alaska, in the State Capitol Room 532 in Senate Finance. Before the committee this evening is SB 114 and SB 128, Permanent Fund Earnings Deposits, Dividends, and Accounts. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? With me at the table this evening, Senator Olson.
Good evening, Madam Chairman.
Senator Dunleavy. Senator Kelly.
Hello, Madam Chair.
We should be joined shortly by Senator Machicki's in committee, as well as Senator Hoffman. Senator Bishop is on other state business today. I'd like to invite Commissioner Hoffback to the table and recognize that Attorney General Richards is in the audience for questions. Commissioner Hoffback, if you could state your name for the record, introduce yourself, and as I understand it, introduce our presentation this evening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. I just wanted to just make a little brief statement and introduce our presenter. As the Permanent Fund Protection Act was being put together this year, and with fairly substantial modeling that was done primarily internally within the Department of Revenue Economic Research Group. As we started to come to some consensus and conclusions on what the numbers were, we also recognized the fact that this is a very major policy decision, and that we really wanted to have a third party come in and fully vet the assumptions and the modeling that we had done to make sure that, in fact, the results were appropriate for what we were going to ask the legislature to do. And so we put out an RFP. McKinsey & Company was a successful bidder, and were hired to do the analysis. McKinsey & Company is a global management consulting firm that serves basically a worldwide leader in business, government, nonprofit consulting. Over the last 5 years, McKinsey's supported more than 300 public finance projects in 35 countries. They're a leading advisor to institutional investors, including sovereign wealth funds and U.S. state pension funds. They've advised other petro-rich states that have considered adopting fixed dividend type models for their sovereign wealth funds and have substantial experience reviewing financial models. And given the fiscal significance of the governor's proposal, we sought this independent, fact-based assessment of our financial model, and Dr. Bailey's testimony today will share some of the insights that McKinsey & Company found in reviewing the model. Just real briefly, Dr. Bailey is a senior fellow and holds the Bernard L. Schwartz Chair in Economic Policy Development at the Brookings Institute in Washington. He studies economic growth, financial regulation, monetary and fiscal policy. He sits on the board of the Phoenix Companies of Hartford, Connecticut, where he serves as the chairman of the Finance and Investment Committee. Dr. Bailey served as the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from 1999 to 2001. He earned his PhD in economics in 1972 at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's taught at MIT, Yale, and the University of Maryland, and he's the author of many articles and books. He's currently an external advisor to McKinsey and has been asked to provide expert input on the fact-based assessment of the financial model built by the Department of Revenue for the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act. And their lawyers say I need to add this. His testimony does not represent the views of the Brookings Institute or the Phoenix Companies. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Bailey.
Mr. Hoffback, thank you for that introduction. I would like to let the public know that the presentation that we're about to view is available online, State of Alaska website and the Senate Finance Committee, Ensuring a Sound Fiscal Plan. It's dated April 4th, 2013. I'd also like to welcome Senator Hoffman to the table. Mr. Bailey, if you could introduce yourself for the record so that our secretaries have your voice associated with a name and an affiliation, okay. That would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Martin Bailey, and I'm testifying here today. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify today. I'm going to present an objective assessment of the model built by the Department of Revenue to test the viability of the proposed draw from the earnings reserve. This is outlined in the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act, and this work was carried out by McKinsey & Company, and I worked with that company on it. So I'd first like to begin with an overview of what's included in my presentation to you today. This is rather a dense slide, but let me just try to summarize what's in it. So the first step, I want to review the Act itself and what it does. So under the current system, production taxes and royalties largely go into the general fund for year-to-year spending. Under this legislation, production taxes and half of royalties would be put into the permanent fund and withdraw the amount that the model determines to be sustainable for general fund spending, so that instead of having the ups and downs of oil prices reflected in spending, we have a stable draw and thereby stabilize general fund expenditures. The dividend currently is half realized earnings, but under the proposal, the dividend would be half of annual royalties. The main purpose, and let me pause on this for a minute, the main purpose of the Act is to improve budget stability and to de-link spending from volatile oil prices and volatile investment returns. So that's really one of the main purposes of what this plan is and what the model is designed to do. The Department of Revenue undertook an extensive exercise to use the financial model to determine how large an amount could be drawn sustainably, that is, how much the state could draw, and expect that the fund value will be maintained and the earnings reserve will be sufficient. Also, and an important point to pause on, the draw will be revisited on a regular four-year cycle, and that will end additional confidence in the sustainability of this plan. The state sought an independent review of the model, and that was done by McKinsey, as we've heard, and I worked with McKinsey on that review. So if we turn now to slide three, let me talk about the overview of the conclusions that were reached in that assessment. This is an overview, so we'll go into more details on each particular element of this. I'm not going to do more than just outline that at the moment. And you can decide as you wish how much of the detail we go into as we go forward and how much we want to move ahead more quickly. The first thing is we found that the DOR model is sound in its methodology and its use of Monte Carlo probabilistic modeling. Now I want to pause on that as well, because Monte Carlo probabilistic modeling is not necessarily that familiar to everyone. So the idea is that what do you do in a situation where you just have a great deal of uncertainty about some of the important variables, revenue sources of revenue, whatever, that go into the budget. So what do you do about that? You can either sort of make a guess or a forecast about what the particular variable will be, or you can say, no, we have to really reckon with the uncertainty that's intrinsic to that. And this is what was done here. So that there are variables, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. The oil price particularly, and we've seen oil prices go from 100 and some down to 30, and oil prices have fluctuated very wildly over the last many years. Also, investment returns. You don't know what the investment returns are going to be 1 year versus the next year. So do you try to build a framework in which that variability, that uncertainty, if you like, is somehow managed? Can you find a management tool that will tame, if you like, that uncertainty using the reserves that you have built up, the funds that you have built up in Alaska, and are able then to translate what is an extremely variable flow of revenues into a more stable budget process? And that's why the Monte Carlo method is used. It's widely used. It's used a lot. It's used by banks. It's used by pension funds. It's used by sovereign wealth funds around the world. So it's not something that's coming out of just out of thin air. It's been around for a long time and been very widely used.
Mr. Bailey, if I could ask you to pause for just a moment. Welcome, Senator Michicki. I did let the public know that you were in the Resource Committee, so thank you for joining us. Mr. Bailey, would you like questions to be held until your presentation is complete, or would you like them a slide by slide? What's your preference?
I'm willing to do it either way. Madam Chair, either way, if you'd like to take a question when it's, you think it's most relevant, or if you'd rather wait and we'll go through a few slides, I'm happy to do it either way, really.
Well, we'll try to wait right now, and I'll ask members to write your questions down on the slide. That will give the presenter an opportunity to get through the meat of his presentation before we start asking
questions. Okay. Okay. That's good. All right. Second step is we looked at the assumptions, and they were deemed to be reasonable when they were valid against objective third-party sources. So we looked at what has been done. We looked at what other people say about oil prices or whatever, and we deemed those assumptions to be reasonable. And third, the model was informed by best practices of what other sovereign wealth funds and as I said, other pension funds and so on have done. Obviously, it had to be tailored to the context of Alaska, which has unique circumstances. If we move forward to the next slide. So now I want to say a few words about the scope of the discussion. First, we can talk about the vetting of the methodology used in the model and the appropriateness of Monte Carlo analysis, and I've actually gotten ahead of myself and said a bit about that already. Second, we can discuss the reasonableness of the assumptions, oil price, oil production, investment returns. And thirdly, in terms of the sovereign wealth fund best practices, I want to touch on one key point, and that is the importance of systematic savings and investment rules within sovereign wealth funds. We turn to the next slide. So this one gives an example, and there are many more, but these are three, I think, helpful examples. So the first one is Singapore. So Singapore has a sovereign wealth fund, the GIC. It has developed a proprietary internal model, and it projects 20-year returns. So they actually try to make projections or forecasts of 20-year returns. The government of Singapore has specific rules. It's allowed to spend 50% of the annualized 20-year expected return, and that gives the government flexibility on a year-by-year basis on how much to draw, but capping outflows at a low enough level so that they continue to grow the corpus of the fund. The National Fund of Kazakhstan. Now, that was a fund that was a country that has had budget problems and has gotten into difficulties. They had suffered from discretionary draws, so they had drawn out money from the corpus. But they decided that wasn't working. They needed to bring a little more discipline in the process. So under the 2010 reforms, the annual draw is fixed at $8 billion, and that used to reduce budget deficits and for economic development. It can adjust the draw by 15% as it did. If the balance of the National Fund falls below 20% of Kazakh GDP, so they're trying to maintain, make sure that they preserve that corpus, and they must reduce the annual draw and get back to where their target is again. And then many of you may know the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, one of the best run around, and they have a bipartisan balanced budget consensus, which actually limits the amount of government non-oil deficits to 4% of their GDP. And they protect the corpus of the fund. And unless there's a stipulation that if their investments earn more than the 4% real return that they're targeted to earn, then that gives them additional budget flexibility. But again, there are very clear rules about what can be done and what can't be done and what provides budget discipline. So again, to repeat, I think there's a lot of literature, and I think you may have had some prior testimony on this about best practices among sovereign wealth funds, the need to have rules, and not to have sudden ad hoc spending when things go well, and then huge cuts when things go badly. So that's been the experience that I think we can learn from what other countries have done. Okay, now let's look at how the model actually works, and it'll take several slides to get through this, but let's just get the outline. So the first question is, what are the major inflows into the fund? And as you know, those are production tax revenues, royalty revenues, and investment returns. So those are the core sources of cash that go in. So what is going to drive the inflows in the future? Obviously, the volume of oil production is very important, how much oil is being produced here in Alaska, what the oil price will be, which is a world will lower price and what the investment returns will be. And you have a distinction, total and statutory returns, and then we have to distinguish both of those. Obviously, investment returns are going to depend, again, mostly on what happens to U.S. markets and, to some extent, global markets. Okay, so the third element we've highlighted here is to test the sustainability of the draw. So you want something that's going to work in the future going forward. And sustainability here has been defined as at least 50% confidence that the fund value will be maintained, as well as confidence in the earnings reserve durability. So there's money in the earnings reserve when it comes time to make the draw to fund state spending. Yes, but let's turn the next page. Now, this page, regret that it's a little bit complicated, and again, let me try to sort of boil it down to how would you actually put a Monte Carlo model together. So we've done the first step. We've identified what the key revenue drivers are. The second step is you have to determine how much variability, the highs and lows, the middle range, and you have to provide some level of a probability distribution. That's to say, how likely are we to get high values, how likely are we to get low values, how likely values in the middle. So that's the step that you have to do in order to sort of capture this uncertainty that's part of the environment that you're facing for these key drivers. And third, you have to understand the impact of those drivers on cash flows. And I'm sure, as you well know, in terms of the oil revenue, for example, if oil prices are very high, then the revenues to the state go extremely high. That's sort of almost a multiplier that kicks in. If oil prices drop below a certain point, basically most of that revenue disappears. So that sort of highlights the challenge, if you like, that you're facing in putting this model together, or indeed in trying to make stable, sound budget plans, because there's that much variability. There's this huge variability in the revenues that you get from the oil production in the state. And we've experienced those ups and downs in just the last few years. Let's turn the next slide. So this is a pyramid familiar to any of you who know McKinsey's work. This sort of is a representation, an illustration, if you like, of what McKinsey does. It creates an evaluation framework. So obviously the evaluation that was done here was unique. It was for Alaska and based on the factors that are relevant for Alaska. But underlying that is a methodology or an approach that's been used many, many times in the past with different kinds of clients, with different countries around the world. How do you go about assessing the plans that they're putting together to try to manage their sovereign wealth funds or their pension funds? And so the sovereign wealth fund model is at the top there. Then the checking goes on at the assumptions level and at the methodology level. So we've got the right assumptions. Are we putting them together in the model in the right way? And at the bottom here, you have the pieces. Again, we've seen these before, the oil revenues and production, investment returns. And then there's the structure of the model. Does it actually do the things it's intending to do? And is it based on a sound logic, and are the concepts put together in the right way? And then finally, has the process been gone through in a way that gets you to a sound result, so that ideally something that's repeatable, something that the process at least is as transparent as you can make it. Now, this, I think, is a very important chart, and I'd like to spend a minute or two talking about it. First point to notice is that this is about the earnings reserve. So this is the model has an estimate that looks at the distribution of outcomes for the earnings reserve, and what we plot here is the cumulative confidence over time of whether a $3.3 billion draw could be made from the earnings reserve, given what's been fed into the model in terms of the oil prices and production and so on. Okay. The first thing to look at, this is really good news. If you look from 2017 all the way out to 2022, you've got essentially 100% probability that there's enough money there and that the earnings reserve is sufficient. Even if you go out another 5-10 years, you're still well over 90% probability. For this kind of modeling, for this kind of approach, for dealing with the amount of uncertainty that is part of your environment with oil prices and earnings, those are very high numbers. Now, one thing you could do, and this is what sort of this model does, is you could put your whole this whole plan on autopilot. You could just let it run forward for the next 40 years and say, we're not going to re-examine it until 2040. We're just going to let it run. And so if you go all the way out to 2040 and you see the number there is 69%, and so you say, well, 69, is that high or low? Well, it's more than two-thirds. It's actually quite a good probability that your earnings reserve will still be have enough money in it to make the draw. On the other hand, you could say, well, is that really so great? You've got 30% or so, then it would not be available. But I think the key point to make, there are a couple of key points to make. First of all, going out to 2040 is really a pretty long time. And so always with these kinds of models, when there's a lot of uncertainty, inevitably, as you run them out into the future, you're going to get a reduction in the confidence that you can meet any particular requirement. Second, I think, important point to make is that you don't have to just put it on autopilot. Every 4 years, in fact, I think the first one starts before that, you can do a periodic review and determine whether things are working out, whether there looks to be the kind of money coming in, the distribution of these variables turns out to be still a sound, or if you find that's not the case, you would have to adjust your reckoning, and maybe you would lower down the $3.3 billion draw if it turned out that that was necessary in order to avoid depleting the earnings reserve. So, I'm sorry, are you...
I've got a question for you.
Yeah, please.
Mr. Bailey, Senator Kelly has a question.
Your model here assumes the $3.3 billion draw from, or the $3 billion draw from the CBR. Most of us don't believe that's possible politically. And I just wondered if you have later on any of the slides that show what your probabilities are removing that $3 billion draw.
This model was run under the assumption that $3 billion was brought into the earnings reserve and that started with $10 billion. We did not run this model at the lower level of $7 billion. If it had been run, I think there's no secret about it would have to change. You would have to lower the amount of the draw, and you would probably not have quite the same level of confidence that you could have enough money in the earnings reserve going forward. So it would have both effects if you did not have the $3 billion in there. By the way, though, you do have the opportunity in the periodic review, so you would still have that as something that you could adjust if you were finding you were running out.
Senator Michiki.
I was saving all until the end, but I just got a couple quick ones. How does a single significant failure affect the future cumulative confidence?
I think I think that you would be able to see a significant failure coming. I mean, I think there's enough money coming in and enough money in the earnings reserve that you would be able to anticipate that was necessary to make an adjustment in order to do that. If you then were in that situation, you would then have to sort of rerun the model and assess what the confidence would be under the new situation that you were in. So is that an answer to your question or not? No.
it is, Madam Chair, if I just quick follow-up.
Senator Machicki.
And it would be very interesting to see this slide without the CBR infusion as well. I mean, clearly the 3.3 becomes a more challenging test. I don't know if that's possible, Madam Chair, but that would be an interesting slide to see.
Yes.
Senator Machicki, we have that data. I passed it out last week of what it would look like, not necessarily on Mr. Bailey's slide, but there's a memo on that from the department already, I believe. Do you remember? I'm not sure if you were.
I don't remember a cumulative confidence level slide with them, but love to see it if you have it in your possession, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hoffbeck, that's not the exact kind of information we had. We passed. Can you give it? Can you provide that to the committee? I see Attorney General Richards nodding his head in the affirmative that we can get that run without the transfer of the CBR dollars.
Madam Chair, yes, we could. It would be the economic research can run it. It won't be McKinsey that ran it, but it'll be the same model that McKinsey had reviewed, just with the lower input.
And can we have a date specific on that, considering we're in the last few days, we hope, of session?
I would hope we can get it to you in a day or two.
Thank you.
Shall I continue?
I have lots of questions, but I can wait till the
okay.
To the end.
Okay, the next slide. That takes on the question of the permanent fund. And what we found when we ran, again, these simulation models was that the median value, or the most likely outcome, under the conditions being specified, was that the permanent fund would be $96 billion in 2040, and that's an inflation-adjusted number. Now, you can also see that there's a range of uncertainty around that, and as always happens when you go out in any forward-looking estimate or calculation, that range will get wider the further you go out. As you can see, there's a fairly large upward range, so that there's many outcomes where the permanent fund would be larger than $96 billion. There are some that fall below that. Over time, again, the ability to revisit the draw on a four-year basis gives you an additional confidence that you would be able to preserve the fund's balance as you're required to do. You would have to, again, adjust the draw in order to do that if it turned out that you were headed towards the fund dropping below its target point. Turn to the next page. Now I'm going to review the assessment that was done to validate this model. And again, I'm happy to go into greater or lesser depth if that's useful. So we assessed the assumptions that went into it and then compared them with objective third-party sources to ensure that they were reasonable. We also assessed the methodology used, which includes this Monte Carlo approach for oil price and investment returns, which we determined to be best practice. We also worked with the Department of Revenue to make changes in the model and provide an agenda for future improvements. So there were some improvements made along the way, and there's an agenda, a modest agenda, for possible changes in the future if the model continues to be used in this way. Obviously, the key assumptions, I don't think I need to repeat this, they go around future oil prices, oil production, investment returns, and so on. And the methodology approach, I think we've talked about Monte Carlo. I'm happy to come back and talk about it again, but I'll skip it again for now. So again, drilling down a little bit on each of these pieces, this slide looks in more detail at the four critical drivers: crude price, production volume, total returns, statutory returns. So how did we go about assessing the reasonableness of these? As it indicates on this slide, for the crude price, we look for some third-party forecasters and estimators, WoodMac and Rystat, and there were others, and McKinsey's energy practice is familiar with projections for oil prices. And we found that the range that was being used, and the distribution that was being used by DOR, we found that was DOR was useful, was reasonable. For total and statutory returns, we looked at third-party projections, and we also spoke with investors at the permanent fund. So we double-checked the information that came to us from Callan and the estimates that they have made. We turn to the next slide. Now another favorite, why we use a deterministic versus a Monte Carlo analysis. And when would you use one and when would you use another? So one variable we did not posit as a probabilistic variable, and that was future production of oil in Alaska. And we didn't do that, not because we exactly know what it's going to be, but we think that we can get a forecast. DOR gets its forecast working with the companies that are working in Alaska, as well as third-party estimates, and they can form a pretty good view of what they think oil production is going to be going forward. In point of fact, they come up with a pretty conservative estimate for what oil production would be. It's really based on either oil that's currently being produced, or if there are new projects, these are projects that are underway. So in that sense, it was a fairly conservative number that we used. But we didn't try to put a probability distribution around that, because that is not a volatile number in quite the same way as the others. So you use that deterministic approach when you think you're reasonably confident that you know within a reasonable fit where this line is going to go. When you don't know where it's going to go, and we've seen with oil prices and investment returns that go up and down and up and down in a way that's very random, then you have to use something like Monte Carlo. And as I've said, it's a way of managing that uncertainty. Uncertainty is always something that we have to learn to live with, and the Alaska budget is prone to a lot of uncertainty because of those variable flows of funds coming into the budget. And that's why we use the probabilistic way to recognize and then learn to manage that. And I mentioned earlier also that with oil prices, that variability is kind of magnified by the fact that oil prices get you a real ton of money and low oil prices get you very little. So this chart is is sort of an assessment chart. I don't want to go into detail here. I'm willing to do so if you'd like to press for questions. It's meant to illustrate that this was a really pretty thorough and careful assessment. We didn't just come in and take what was there. We really tested and looked for robustness in all the aspects of the model, how it's run, what it assumes, how the results are presented, and so on. We also added here, as I mentioned, some places where there could be some improvements. And I want to stress that those are not things that undermine the quality of the model. We believe the model works and does what it says it does. But in areas where it could be improved, to develop a consistent process for sort of developing and evolving this model, making sure who has ownership of it within the administration, who collects the data, what data is brought into play, and so on, that should be known and repeatable so that this model could be used consistently in future and adjusted if it were needed to be adjusted. So we look at the next slide. This one is even more fun. It shows the probability distributions around the three variables that are treated in a probabilistic way, and that's the crude selling price, the total return rate, and the statutory net income. So the crude selling price used so-called PERT distribution or triangular distribution, where the the effort is made to find experts and ask them, what do you think the P10 price is, what do you think the low price is, what do you think the median price is, the 56, what do you think the high price is of 87, and can we assess roughly what the probabilities around those three alternative outcomes are? So you do get a basic estimate of the probability distribution. And that was done by DUR and the Economic Research Group that does these crude price projections. Production volume I've already talked about, not much volatility. It's on a downward trend, and that was assumed to be the case. On the returns, for total returns, where we looked at the total returns on the portfolio, we were able to compare with other asset funds and make an assessment of what we thought of the returns assumptions that were being made. So there's lots of funds that we know about, there are lots of public funds, and so we can come up with an assessment of, given the type of assets they're holding and the proportions in which they're holding them, what are the likely mean rate of return going forward, and what would be the standard deviation on that. And a normal distribution was applied to that total return rate. So we were able to verify this both through our own work, and we checked with Callahan and looked at what they'd done, and this is where we got this distribution. Now, the statutory net income is a little bit more difficult to do because obviously there are not comparable numbers out there that you can just that you could look at and compare and have you got it too high or low because obviously the statutory net income depends on the particular statutes and the asset classes and so on and realized unrealized gains and losses and how those are counted in the case of Alaska. So there we were basically much more dependent on Callan, and they provided us another so-called PERT or triangular distribution. What's the low value of returns, what's the medium value and the high value of returns, and what's the rough distribution no likelihood around each of those. And so we were satisfied that this was done in a reliable way. We weren't able to unscramble that omelet as easily to get at what was inside it. So when we did the review, there were some suggested changes that were made, and one in particular. The original model did have both the earnings reserve and the fund, the permanent fund, but those two tests of sustainability were not integrated together, and we felt they should be that should be done, and we worked with DOR to integrate those two together so that we could get an answer that we felt more confident on, that we were getting the best estimate of the likelihood of the earnings reserve and the permanent fund meeting the criteria that they needed to meet. We also would think there would be more information that we could get from Callan in terms of how they calculate the those returns. That would also be helpful. But again, the basic model we believe is sound. There can be improvements, but there's nothing in there that we think is going to be undermining to the model itself. Can we look to the next slide? So when we looked at each of these variables and we compared them to third-party sources, here's what we found. The oil price was roughly in line with third-party estimates, and I've listed a couple there of the third-party estimates that make estimates in different ways. Some of them come from the bottom up, trying to assess each active oil field and so on. That would be too cumbersome to repeat that process. But what the answers that they came out with, we felt were in line with the assumptions that were being put into the model. I mentioned crude production and that it's conservative, as I already talked about that. I think I've also talked about the total returns using the Callan mean variance. This we could compare, and we can compare with places like Bridgewater and AQR and Goldman Sachs and other companies that have funds. And again, this can be done at an asset-by-asset level, not just at the overall fund. So we can capture the particular IDA parts of the asset fund. The statutory net returns, I think I'm repeating myself at this point, but this was the 10-year estimate and came from Callan based on their calculations. We turn the slide forward one more time. So again, as I said, we identified an agenda for future improvements, particularly if there were certain changes, which there may well be. If there's a shift in asset allocation, you shift towards different kind of assets, more into bonds or away from bonds, more into real estate or out of real estate. If the fund's mandate changed, or if there were the investment strategy changed, if there were new liquidity constraints so that you had to make sure there was enough cash, you don't want to be selling things and get caught out selling them at the bottom of the market. You want to have enough liquidity and make sure that payments can be made and made into the earnings reserve. If there were new tax policies here in the state, that would also affect the outcome. So that brings me to the end of the formal presentation. I do want to conclude on what I would like to be a pretty upbeat note, because we did find that this plan from the DOR was designed in a very effective way to take account of the volatile earnings and petroleum revenues that the state of Alaska has, and then translate them, manage those uncertainties in the way that you can draw, make a stable draw into state spending. Excuse me. And so the goal here is it seems like how can you do this? You've got all this variability, and you want a stable annual draw. And I think this model really is able to do that. We felt that it was successful in doing that. A second, again, positive note that I would like to sound is that this provides a rules-based framework. So to go back to what Norway or Singapore are doing, that's consistent with best practices, so that you bring some, not to take away the right and obligation to policymakers to make policy, but to have a set of rules around which the choices are made, so that you don't, you preserve the fund for the future, and you can have the degree of stability into budget planning, which we feel is important. The model and the assumptions are sound, and McKinsey found that this model does do what it says it does. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On
slide 20. Slide 20 at the top. Assumptions appear generally reasonable. Returns projections are perhaps aggressive in the near term. Can you explain that a little more?
I'm sorry, where was this again?
Up top, the return projections are perhaps aggressive in the near term. Can you add a little detail to that?
In the title. There's obviously a lot of uncertainty in markets. 6.9% real return is a pretty high return. We feel that that is something that is achievable over the long run. So I don't think that this is aggressive over the time period of this model that's playing out. But it could be, as you know, markets have been fairly weak at the end of 2015 and a little weak into 16, but also those markets are actually now reversed. So a lot of the fall off that happened in the first months of the fiscal year have actually gotten a return. But given the uncertainty, I think when this page was written, there was probably more uncertainty in global markets than there is today. There was concern that China was going down, and maybe that would affect returns and so on. So I think it was just a sense of being careful that maybe you wouldn't necessarily get that number in the very short run, but it didn't change our view that it was a sustainable target, sustainable expectation for the longer run.
Senator Michiki.
Thank you. I'm sort of along those same lines. On page 3, you talk about investment returns assumptions are reasonable. I always, there's a lot of room for, there's a lot of room in the word reasonable. But you say, though.
I think we think we know what we mean by reasonable, but go ahead.
So though we're considered optimistic for the near term by some members of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation investment staff, and we're higher than those projected by the strategic partners, third-party asset managers, just on the conservatism of the assumptions, is there any, in your experience, do local fund managers that have an experience with that particular asset allocation have a higher expertise than someone who's just generally evaluating that portfolio just due to watching various performance levels over the last several years?
So are you sort of saying maybe the people who've been running this portfolio know more about the returns than McKinsey does coming in from the outside? Okay, well, maybe. But I suspect you're going to follow up on that, or you just want a straight answer to that question.
No, I can follow up if you'd like, and then you can just give me one big one, big answer at the end. But there's nothing. I love how many experts come out after a severe correction, that they saw it coming, that we don't hear from in advance. But when you think about the outliers, considering that you have a 6.9% mean and a 13.9% standard deviation on the total return rate, what happens in the outlier years to this model? Think about the Dow 1919 or 29 or the 60s through the 80s. 2000 or 2009, what happens to this model when you have a severe correction?
Well, it is surprisingly robust. I can't tell you there isn't some catastrophe to markets that couldn't derail the model and would require a reassessment of what the draw should be or how the budgeting should be done. But it is surprisingly robust. We really have not had long periods of down returns in the entire post-World War II period. I mean, about the worst economic period that I know about is 2008-2009, when we had the financial crisis and markets crashed, and for a while we sort of didn't know what was going to happen. And the Dow or the S&P really fell through the floor, and a lot of other private equity investments and bonds were failing. So that was a pretty catastrophic period. But if you actually look at markets over that period, it was really only, I think, 1 year or possibly two, 1 year that the markets were down, and then they bounced back quite a bit. A previous episode was the dot-com bust around 2000 and 2001. So there were a couple of years of down markets then that we experienced during the recessions in 1975 or in 1982. We had down markets. But it really is pretty, these markets are pretty robust. I mean, the American economy is quite diverse and has been a very strong performer and a very consistent performer.
Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 21, you have at the bottom, it talks about new tax proposals. And I think the comment in there is that oil and gas revenue are a relatively small percentage of revenue. But we've seen with tax proposals that they do.
Is it this slide or 21?
21.
21.
What we've seen with tax proposals is that they do bend the production curve, and production is not a small portion of the permanent fund because we get royalties. Is that considered, or were you only considering the production tax, or were you considering, considering the royalties as well?
My understanding is the royalties and the taxes were both considered in this.
Senator Machicki?
Just a follow-up. I'm not sure I would buy equities on your guarantee that markets are just going to be robust. And you didn't really answer my question on the effects of a drawn-out correction. And the only reason I ask is we're looking at a choice between a likely POMV and the robust success of a fixed draw. I personally would rather live without our means, within our means, if there's an extended period of correction. But the question I asked is, what happens to a fixed draw if, although I agree that markets seem to be relatively robust, things happen and unprecedented corrections will likely occur in the future. If they're extended, what happens to a fixed draw model?
Well, there would have to be a periodic review. I don't know whether you would like to speak to that point also.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. Yeah, that's why we put the four-year periodic review in there, was on the off chance that we would get a prolonged period like we have right now, where we have low oil prices and low market returns. You know, historically, they tend to be countercyclical. And this is kind of an anomaly that they're both down at the same time. But it would take multiple years of this phenomena in order to bust the model. And that's why with that four-year review, we think there's sufficient time to be able to make the adjustment prior to it busting the model.
One more, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
So. One more question, and that is why, if that kind of a situation would put you in an adjustment mode, why wouldn't you always remain in adjustment mode with a POMV? Which model is superior for, POMV never fails a test, right? And a fixed draw can.
Well, let me stress, our task was to evaluate this model, and, you know, it is a probabilistic model, and we found it to be very robust, and given the parameters that were put into it. Now, if you're comparing to a POMV, the difficulty with a POMV is that, say, particularly if you say you look 6 years back or something like that and said we'd average what over the last 5 or 6 years and we'll take a percentage of that. One danger with that is that if you go back the years when oil prices were so high and the revenues were so large, and really around the same time investment returns were very high, so if you build your budget and your spending on that period, then you're going to, you know, have lots of money to spend, but then a few years later when you're into a period when markets are not so high and oil prices are low, then all of a sudden you've got to make very draconian changes in your budget. So the advantage that of the DOR proposal as we see it, and it's similar, you know, in essence to the way other countries, other institutions run their affairs, is to try to get as much stability as they can take account of the uncertainty, recognizing you'll get those periods of high and periods of low, but that there's enough robustness, there's enough meat in the funds so that you're not going to run out unless you're in a very unusual circumstance, something that's very unlikely according to the runs of this model. I'm trying to be as honest as I can with you, Senator. I think that there's always a possibility of a catastrophe. I mean, that's always a possibility. But I think the goal in this budget process is to find something that's robust to normal circumstances and, you know, even fairly abnormal circumstances where oil prices are really. I mean, they were 100 and some, and now they're 30. So we're in pretty abnormal circumstances right now. So that's what we're trying to do, the smoothing, so that we're not getting buffeted around all the time by those ups and downs. I apologize, Madam Chair. I realize that there's an etiquette when I'm answering questions that I'm not necessarily following as answering the question through the chair, and I apologize. I mean no disrespect by that.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Senator Dunleavy.
Just have a quick at ease, just very quick.
Certainly. At ease? On the record, Commissioner Hoffbeck.
I guess I just want to make just a real brief comment on the POMV. If you, particularly if you're using a multi-year average coming into a POMV, and then followed by, so you had a real robust returns like we had in the last 5 years, followed by low market returns for multiple years, the POMV could bust the earnings reserve fund just like a fixed draw could. And the assumption is that in either case, you're going to review and you're going to adjust if you see that occurring. So although the POMV is more dynamic in adjusting, a sustained period of low returns could bust the earnings reserve even under a POMV if it's not monitored and adjusted.
Other questions from committee members? I know that you know that I have some. I know. So if we could start on slide 3. Mr. Bailey, on bullet point number 3, or target number 3, certain institutional investors' best practices could help improve the plan's long-term sustainability. Did you then run the variables between what the rates of returns that the Alaska Permanent Fund had accomplished versus the national averages? Is that where you based that?
No, I think there's a different meaning. That was more around the idea of getting a clear ownership of the model. It was really about the practices around building and preserving the model. It was not so much about running in different with different returns. No, it was some of the things in one of the later slides that talks about how you could. You know, who's collecting the information, where's the inflation coming from, who has ownership of that information, and can we make sure it's done in the best way to give the best inputs into the model. So it's more about the process behind the building of the model.
Commissioner, the reason I ask that is the bullet point says the state of Alaska could further strengthen the long-term viability of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, at least if I'm reading that right, and the sustainability of the contributions to the general fund by leveraging best practices learned from other sovereign wealth funds and investors. And so I believe we're locating the management over at the corporation. And so I'm wondering if then we're supposed to, I have a note that I wanted to talk with the Permanent Fund Board because it's talking about training government officials. Certainly we could use additional training on the models.
Yes, exactly. That was one of the suggestions, I think.
But it talks about communication regularly between investors and sponsors, which would be under the hat of the Permanent Fund Board Corporation. So do you see a weakness, Mr. Bailey, in the practices that are happening there? Because some of these are management tools and some of these are spending and some of them are administration issues. Are you just putting them all together then?
I think we were putting them together, yes. I would not say it's a weakness. I think it was something that we identified that would be a path towards improvement.
Thank you. On slide number 5, there's a group of red X's that wasn't in the scope. I just want to confirm that was in the scope of your evaluation.
It was not in the scope of our evaluation. That's correct.
So to the Commissioner of Revenue or to the Attorney General, were the items that are noted that were not in the scope done by the administration?
Madam Chair, they were done, Madam Chair.
Holistic evaluation of the proposed budget and budget deficit?
Yes, Madam Chair. Because this was all part of the budget package, this was all tied to long-term budgeting strategy, and something that McKinsey was not asked to do, to look at the state's budget holistically. But the state, but as within revenue, we within state in general, working with OMB and others, we did look at the holistic look at the budget. Yes.
Commissioner, do we have a macroeconomic study of future market fundamentals available? Is that over at the Permanent Fund Board and under their wheelhouse?
Madam Chair, that was primarily done just based on reports that we received from Callan and others that we get at revenue through the Permanent Fund. We didn't do a separate macroeconomic study, no. But the data is available. So.
Moving on to slide 6. General Richards, would you like to come up and join us at the microphone? I know that you've been involved, and so if you have comments that you'd like to make, if I'm not asking the right person, I'm happy to get it on the record so that you have an opportunity to respond. I'm looking at page 6 and the non-oil deficit to 4 percentage points. I thought that was interesting, considering the volatility and the magnitude that oil has contributed in the past at up to 95% of Alaska's general fund dollars, and our other revenue sources being so small as a percentage. And I was wondering if there was consideration of the limit that we've been talking about on the deficit on non-oil deficits. Was that a consideration that your model took into effect or took into consideration?
Madam Chairwoman, Craig Richards, Attorney General, for the record. It was taken into the account in the sense that we realized that we couldn't follow Norway's rules-based system. Their rules-based system is really one where they save all of their petroleum revenues into their sovereign wealth funds, and they largely budget off of broad-based taxation. Mm-hmm. So that not being a practical rule for Alaska, because you really couldn't tax at a level that would equate to, our current budget levels, it wasn't one that we really looked to duplicate.
I thought it was an interesting trigger to actually apply to help us manage the volatility on the other side. The other interesting piece on this slide was the Singapore model. Did you look at a 20-year prospective look of annualizing expected returns to establish a draw versus the annuity style? Yeah, Senator Michikee started to get to it when he was talking about respectively looking at under an endowment approach, looking at what past performance was, and Mr. Bailey suggested that 6 years was absolutely too long, but there is a way to balance that return out and do a blended rate where we looked retrospectively and then capped at a particular level the draw to blend the two concepts together. But did you explore the sensitivity of what Singapore is doing?
Madam Chairwoman, we didn't exactly look at the Singapore model, but that model is extremely close to what we did, right? We took the expected annualized 24-year returns of the permanent fund and then calculated a draw amount that equated to maintaining the real value of the fund so after inflation. So rather than a 20-year expected return, we did 24, and rather than you're allowed to spend 50%, we did you're allowed to spend the amount of return over inflation. So that's very similar. And in terms of the historic returns, we also looked at that option. And in fact, the first time the bill was dropped, you probably don't remember because it got amended before we actually got into this legislative session. We had originally put into the bill that we would do our return based on 50% of the last 10-year average fund performance and then 50% of your 10-year projection. And one of the things McKinsey did when they came in and did the review is they said, you know, methodologically it's unsound to rely on historic performance. So we took it out. And the reason that it was explained that it was unsound, and I have a finance background, I kind of know this, it's because historical returns are not indicative of future performance, particularly when you have changing asset allocations. So the fact that you might have done well over the last 10 years doesn't mean you'll do well over the next 10 years, particularly when you look at the dynamic of the fact that your asset allocations changes. So you really have different expectations about what you're even trying to achieve versus what you did historically. So that's why we took out the historical use of returns, because the expert said we should.
Commissioner Hoffbeck or General Richards, so it sounds like that we're considering an asset allocation change. And the question that I have then to either of the two of you is that right now the earnings reserve is faring at a 5 to 6% interest rate. I believe that's what's projected going forward. But the CBR is, 2 if we're lucky, because of liquidity. So we've asked this question of other presenters. What's the sensitivity to drawing down the actual earning opportunity inside the earnings reserve by the formula that we're doing? Are we going to now have less money in the earnings reserve because it's just not, it needs to be liquid, so there's not going to be as much cash available to generate earnings?
Madam Chair, there will have to be some level of additional liquidity in order to make the draw. Of course, that liquidity can be managed over whether it's a single draw or whether it's multiple draws through the year. You know, we can manage to that liquidity. So yes, there will be a slight change there. We are not looking at a change in allocation other than that. I think the Attorney General's comment about allocation changes was kind of a historic look at our allocations have changed over the years, and that way, because of that, looking backwards doesn't necessarily tell us what our performance is going to be going forward.
And Madam Chairwoman, they'll continue to change. Regardless of what we do here today, the permanent fund doesn't treat their allocations as static. As the world's change and your investment opportunities change, things will be different. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago the permanent fund might be looking at, 15, 20% one day in private equity and, individual investments? People would have scoffed, but now it looks like the world we're moving to. So,
thank you, General Richards. Commissioner Hoffbeck, then have you forecasted out a lower rate of return because of the liquidity in the earnings reserve?
Madam Chair, we have not.
Madam Chair, I will say that no, we have not. But last time I was here before you, you asked me that same question, and I give you the same answer I did now, which is there will be some impact. We don't think it will be that much, but we don't know the answer. I did have the opportunity at the last board meeting to ask the acting chief investment officer what he thought the impact of the liquidity needs of either a percentage of market value plan or this kind of plan, just an increased draw level would be. And he said it would, I'm paraphrasing, he said that it would be a change, but it would be manageable. But he couldn't quantify it any more than I could in that circumstance.
General Richards, so what I'm trying to get to is inside of the bills that we have before us, I'm wondering if we should change the directive of the CBR if we're going to drop down the rate on the earnings reserve. So if you use the earnings reserve as the vehicle, and that's why I've asked the question now multiple times, and we're going to use a third of it or something close to it every year, and we drive down the earnings, should we change the investment model somewhat on the CBR? Because Commissioner Hoffbach, when he was first here, he and I had a disagreement on a particular action that he took, and I am thankful that he was successful in his endeavor. But because under current state statute, if I quote it correctly, and Commissioner, correct me if I don't, if we need the funds within a period of time, you need to go make sure that those are liquid assets on our behalf ready to be utilized. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, that is accurate. But if the earnings reserve becomes a primary funding source and the CBR really becomes more of the rainy day fund again for emergency non-systematic use, we will reinvest back into the sub-account and change the asset allocation to be more aggressive for returns.
And you believe you can do that without statutory change?
Madam Chair, if we forecast forward, you know, how much do we need within the 5 years? If there's funds that we don't project are necessary within the 5 years, those could have the longer allocation.
Thank you. If we could go on to slide 7. I'm sorry, Mr. Bailey, I will get to a question.
That's quite all right.
Commissioner, oil production, is it up or down this year?
Madam Chair, oil production is up this year. And forecast to be up again next year. I think it drops off the third year out.
But we've got a forecast that shows it down in the model multiple years.
Madam Chair, the forecast numbers that McKinsey had, and when the model was built, did show a decline going forward, but then the numbers are slightly higher 3 or 4 or 5 years out than they are under the new forecast. So overall, it doesn't change very much.
It's a variability in the model that it's important to Alaskans to know that oil production is up and planning to be up, and that is based on policies that the legislature has adopted from at least our perspective. Is that fair? Our perspective. Can you give me that one, Commissioner?
I can agree with that. It's multiple things that have come into play, and that is certainly one of them.
Thank you. On slide 9, Mr. Bailey.
Yes.
I'm looking at your first targeted. It says that the existing DOR sovereign wealth fund model was reviewed along two dimensions, methodology and assumptions. And I'm wondering if other sovereign wealth funds use other dimensions to look at their models.
I have to know, I don't know every sovereign wealth fund, and there may be some special circumstances, but I think the assumptions and the methodology would be the two principal ones that would be used, yes.
Thank you. And then when I look at the base of the pyramid in blue, the extreme, my left must be your right, but where it says oil revenues, oil production, is that weighted in the model in any way, or is this just convenient for this particular slide?
That's really just it's an illustrative slide. It's not meant to be weighted.
Slide number 11, Senator Machicki and Senator Kelly were talking about the $3 billion draw in here. In this probabilistic model, and General Richards came to my office and we talked about this, there was concern raised by several members of our body that if our spring and fall forecasts were so different that you lost $700 million, that there wouldn't be any change to this probabilistic model because of the variables used. And so my question is, if it, first, is it accurate that the value, the per barrel charge and time are the axes that you're considering in the probabilistic model? Time and dollar per barrel. That was a yes?
That was a yes, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to get it so that others can hear it at home. So if that's the two variable and the variable is so wide, so did you include $9 to $150 in the forecast? General Richards is saying yes.
I think we did not. I think it was this PERT distribution, and the high was 96, and the middle was 56, and the low was 30-something.
The P90 and the P6.
Excuse me, yes. Those were the probability points in the distribution. So you could get a higher value up at 120 years.
150 is where we were at. There's a reason I'm asking about the questions and the variability. I'm wondering if the wider you spread the variability on price, whether you get a future problem in the model at the end. Because you've taken such a wide path that how can you have anything go wrong? You have a wide path on dollar value and you have a long 20-year look. Is there any way you can make that model break?
Oh, I think so. It depends on the probability that you put on that very high price. That's not something that we've seen very often nor for very long. And so if you are able to get a right distribution for it, and we did do the verification of the distribution, we got a lot of expert opinion on that as to what the probabilities are associated with. So yes, it happened, but it's a very low probability event, and you're not going to get it for very long or very often.
Mr. Bailey, and that was based on Callan's data?
The price of oil is not Callan, no. The price of oil was based on third-party, the estimators that we looked at in our own energy practice.
Thank you. On slide 11, under bullet point 2, you say $10 billion starting balance means nearly 100% confidence of being able to draw $3.3 billion per year for the first 4 years, even with negative investment returns. And so it was asserted in a previous committee that if negative investment returns happened at the start of your model for a year or two, that the failure rate of the model would go up. Is that an accurate assumption, or can we experience for multiple years negative returns? And I know there's a four-year look, so I know that General Richards and his team have made sure that we can go back and look, but is there a more likely event of failure with more than one negative year of returns?
If you get a whole sequence of large negative returns, clearly that would change the calculation that you would have to make. We did do an assessment of how returns vary from year to year and found a surprisingly little relationship between the return in 1 year and the return in another year. So getting a long run of negatives is something we really have not seen in the post-World War II period and is very unlikely. But obviously it's one of those things that could happen. It's just very unlikely.
Sir.
Through the chair.
McKinsey
didn't work on the PMOV stuff, so that's out of their range. But I would just point out that dynamic, which is true, if you had a series of bad probability events occur on the front end, you certainly increase your chance of running your earnings reserve low. That's true under any approach. It's true under the way we pay out dividends now. It's true under a PMOV model, and it's true here.
Thank you. Are there other questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
Two quick ones. I noticed you picked three sovereign wealth funds on page 6. Curious if their rules are public. It would be interesting for this committee to look at not only the rules of these three sovereign wealth funds, but some of the others that are particularly energy commodity based?
Madam Chair, if I may respond. There have been extensive studies of sovereign wealth funds and their rules. The Balfour Center, which is at Harvard University, has a very large, very extensive, very good report on sovereign wealth funds, looks at a great many of them, assesses the rules. I think many of them are public, certainly the governmental ones. And so there's plenty of information about that available, and we could certainly let you have more information about that.
Follow-up, Senator Michiki.
I just have one more question. And I would be very interested in whatever they can provide, whether it's the administration or whomever. And then page 12, I'm struggling with this a little bit. And of course, we know as well on page 12 that if we the CBR insertion is not successful, this is going to look very different as well. I'm trying to understand if this is meeting or mean. Why are they weighted so heavily from, well, throughout the model toward the negative potential return? I'm sorry, the negative potential balance.
Maybe I'm misreading or misunderstanding you. Overall, so the medians are the most likely. So you run a great many draws. Your computer runs through these different draws, and it tells you what the median, what the 75th percentile, what the 25th percentile is. And those are your estimates of what the probability distribution is of running this out to 2040. So on the median, the permanent fund goes up very substantially, goes up to 96 billion. So I'm missing something, I'm afraid, in your question. There are negative outcomes there, that they are obviously, if the luck of the draw went that way, then there would have to be some adjustment in the draw, you would need to maintain under constitutional provision, you need to maintain the value of the permanent fund. So you have to make adjustments to the drawer in that case.
Follow up, Senator Michiki.
So why is to put it more simply, why is the black dot not in between the 75th and 25th percentile and the median at 115 billion? So we've got a potential high of 34, or low of 34, potential high of 196. Why is the median not 115? That's the part I'm not understanding.
Well, because the model is nonlinear. If you get, say, a high price of oil, you get more bang for the buck out of that than you do for a low price of oil. So it's not a linear model as it's played out. So it doesn't have to be just halfway between.
Senator Michiki?
It's just strangely consistent on the model throughout through 2040.
I don't know. I mean, I think the advantage of this kind of model is that it doesn't just always give you the obvious answer. It forces you to be systematic about what assumptions you feed in. And then it's a fairly powerful tool to tell you what are the implications of those assumptions. I'll be honest. I was, when I first looked at it, I was surprised that the black dot wasn't in the middle. But I think as I thought about it, because of the structure of the model, you've got two different probabilistic variables. Then you've got the oil production, which is trending downwards, so that you don't necessarily get the most obvious result, and that's indeed the part of the value of this exercise.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Mr. Bailey, can you tell us what's in the earnings reserve account on that? If there's 96 billion left in the fund, and I note that expected total balance of the permanent fund in a given year includes the earnings reserve, so...
I don't think I do know what would be in the earnings reserve at that point. It would almost surely be plenty in the earnings reserve, but the exact amount I don't have.
Thank you. It's not necessary. Closing comments, Commissioner Hoffbeck?
Just a brief comment, just to thank you for the opportunity to bring McKinsey here to discuss the model. And it's, we do see it as this is a tremendously important decision to be made long-term for the state of Alaska, and we wanted to get the best information to you and the best people to analyze it. So we just thank you for the opportunity to have McKinsey come here and testify.
Mr. Bailey, closing comments?
Well, thank you for your opportunity. This is I would say my first visit to the state, and it's a beautiful state, and I hope this project that we did proves useful to you as you think about your budget options.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. General Richards, closing comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything from committee members? On Tuesday, I guess, Tuesday, April 5th at 9 o'clock, we'll have the omnibus crime bill back before us. It's our hope to go over the fiscal notes. Because we're at the end of session, things are changing very rapidly about what's before us and what's not. On Tuesday at 1:30, we're holding that open for the crime bill. At this time, I don't know that other bills will come up. And Tuesday, April 5th at 5 p.m., we have SB 126, a small securities offering, SB 154, Blood Bank of Alaska license plate, and SCR 4 U.S., Countermand Convention Delegates. Brief at ease. Back in the record, and tomorrow evening at 5 p.m., we've added SB 69, the Board of Chiropractors. That bill has been before us before and heard the public hearing open and closed. Thank you for attending today. With that, we're adjourned.